I've done this once or twice. How you guys doing? We having a good time this morning? Hey, did everybody get their surface? Anybody waiting still? Yeah. Because, like, they have enough for everybody. You don't have to stand for 2 hours. I was fortunate. I got here, like, Sunday morning at 10:30. And so there was only, like, a half an hour wait. So it wasn't too bad. So how many of you guys had to stand in line for, like, 2 hours and more? Yeah, I'm really sorry. Because, like, they do have plenty for everybody. So they should have done it during registration, don't you think? When you go get your bag, you can pay, you know, swipe your card and get your surface if you want to. I know that's what I expected. So, but those of you who've got your surface, have you figured out how to use it yet? Because I still don't use Windows 8. I still use Windows 7. And I'm going, okay, what do I do now? Right?
Tutorials.
Yeah, exactly. Tutorials.
Yeah. Every demo I see here, the interface with the UIs, all the controls that they want to manipulate are already up and over.
Yes.
It doesn't show up going to buy it.
No, no.
I will tell you the experience on a tablet is much richer than on a laptop.
So the experience on the tablet is richer than on the, like, the desktop machines. That's good to know. Eight, no clue. You guys got to understand, you're sitting here. Now, what is part of the title of this session? PowerShell? I'm a command line guy, okay? I get that. I type in get help, and it tells me everything I need to know. So one of the things that I'm going to ask you guys, though, to think about seriously, after you've left this conference, okay, one of the ways that our community grows is through those of you who are attending these conferences. There isn't a single person here who doesn't have something that the rest of us can learn from. In other words, you all have knowledge that I can learn from. And there's one way for that to happen. It's for you to get up here and share your knowledge. And it does two things. One is I get to learn from you. The other thing is you get to learn it better, because you'll find that something you've been working with for a long time, you really know it well, when you get up to talk about it and explain it to other people, you'll find there's aspects of it that you don't deal with. So you don't have to think about certain things about the technology. And by presenting about it, all of a sudden you do. So you learn more about something you already care about, and we learn from you because you care about that. And that matters so much more than anything else, is that you care about it, right? So by you presenting, you benefit the entire community. So I'm asking you, go back home after the conference, think about what it is that about the technology that really gets you interested, really gets your wheels turning, and then put together a presentation. Go to one of your local user group and ask them if you can present there, because you'll benefit, they'll benefit, and we as a community will benefit. And before long, we'll see you up here. Okay? So I'm asking all that of all of you, because this is really beneficial to the entire community. That's how I got started, right? Go to a user group meeting, they go, we need somebody to talk about PowerShell. Okay. And it's a lot of fun. You meet some incredible people. You get to travel all over interesting places. I will be going and doing the same presentation in Madrid in 3 weeks. So who would have thought I was going to go to Madrid, right? Microsoft's paying. Cool. Wife says, okay, I'm going with you. She was actually here. We came down on Friday to do a little bit of tourism stuff, because she's been going with me since she retired. She was an elementary school principal, and she retired. And since she retired, she decides what interesting cities I'm presenting in, and then she goes along with me. So a few weeks ago, we were in Nottingham, England. So she went with me there. We took a week after that and did a driving tour of Scotland, which was really interesting, learning to drive on the right side of the car on the left side of the road. For those of you from England, you're used to that. For us, it's a little tough. Did get used to it. It was a lot of fun. Saw a lot of interesting places. Castles that have been destroyed and unusable for 500-600 years. Come to New Orleans, take a tour of New Orleans. Oh, this building was built in 1833. Wow. Nothing. I mean, you know. So going from Scotland to New Orleans, it's interesting. It's all good. So how many of you guys have been down Bourbon Street this week? Is that crazy or what? I'm not discriminating. I did take my buddy down to the other end of Bourbon Street, the Lafitte blacksmith shop. Have you been to that down there, the Lafitte blacksmith shop? It's a bar, but it was a blacksmith shop 200 years ago, and it's where Andrew Jackson shook hands with the pirate Jean Lafitte to get Lafitte's men to help Jackson defeat the British in the War of 1812. So that agreement happened in that bar. So I had to go down there and have a beer. Come on, that's history. Lafitte's blacksmith shop. It's on Bourbon Street, down at the other end, beyond where all the craziness is. I forget the intersection, but yeah, my wife and I, we got here on Friday, and while we're walking around the French Quarter, it decided to pour. I mean, absolute downpour for quite a while. So we got onto one of those mule-drawn carriages and took the tour. And that was a lot of fun. So, anybody have time to do any tourism things here in New Orleans? Lots of neat places. Great food. Found a little place called Coop's across Decatur from the Margaritaville place. This little hole-in-the-wall bar, but oh, great food. The Cajun food they had in there was marvelous. There you go, breakfast at Brennan's. No, we were staying at the Wyndham Garden over the weekend, and there's a diner on the corner there. It's a Common and Barone. And I just wanted some pancakes, right? So I ordered a short stack. I'm getting older, I don't eat quite as much. So I ordered a short stack, that's three. And the waitress kind of laughed at me. She goes, are you sure you want three? And I went, what? She goes, our pancakes are pretty large. You probably want to start with one. I went, okay, I'll have one. Literally, it was this big around, and it was this thick. I got through a quarter of the one. It was huge. So yeah, everything is interesting in New Orleans. How close are we to getting ready to start? A couple minute or two? I actually will be talking about SQL Server and PowerShell, okay? I just like to have fun, you know? It's so interesting to get to meet people, and I'm going to apologize to you guys right now because I tend to move to my right when I present. So these guys are going to get a lot more attention than you are, and I'm going to apologize to you right now. I'm going to try and fix that, but I'll do my best. But I do tend to go this way for some reason. Don't know why. I am. There you go. I'm right-handed. That's why. So at some point, if you haven't already done so, get down to Café Du Monde. You gotta try those beignets with the heaping powdered sugar, you know? The ones they had in the exhibition hall last night were good, but they weren't like the Café Du Monde beignets. So that's just a New Orleans experience you have to have. Oh, yeah, watching them make them. Sure, that's great. Oh, by the way, one other comment about when you start presenting, make sure that you have water because you will dry out. Yeah, you can watch them make beignets just a little bit down from there, You can watch them make pralines, and yes, that's how you properly pronounce it. It's pralines. All right? They will correct you. I found out. I came here the first time in 2002. I ran the Mardi Gras Marathon. What an interesting introduction to the city that is. So it was a lot of fun. Finished it, then went out and partied on Bourbon Street. So, all right, I have 10:16 on my watch. Are you guys ready to go? All right, let's get started. I've been talking about me too much, but I'm a practice leader at Upsearch. I've been in IT for a very long time. I've covered a lot of different disciplines, and I've been working with SQL Server, both the Sybase version, the original version started with 4.0 back in 1992, all the versions of Microsoft SQL Server. Since then, I've been certified on SQL Server, I'm an MCT, and I've been an MVP since 2007. So that's enough about me. Let's talk about PowerShell. How many of you have never used PowerShell before? Okay, thank you for coming here. The last session down in the ballroom, one of the ballrooms, Jeffrey Snover did a session just called PowerShell Unplugged, and it was a wonderful session. I wish I could have stayed for the whole thing. PowerShell is part of the Windows Management Framework. It's part of Microsoft's common engineering criteria so that all server products are designed going forward to support PowerShell. All right. PowerShell or Exchange 2007 was completely rewritten by the Exchange team so that all interfaces to Exchange were done via PowerShell. And then they wrote the GUI on top of that so that the GUI called the PowerShell functions to make the changes in Exchange. So there are things you can do through PowerShell with Exchange that you can't do through the GUI. They just didn't write that code. But you could still manage that aspect of it. And that was their thought all along. All right? So then Jeffrey Snover was essentially the founder, the creator of PowerShell. And Jeffrey designed PowerShell 1.0, that came out in 2006 under the code name Monad. In 2009, they released PowerShell 2.0, where they added a lot of functionality to PowerShell. And then he left the PowerShell team and became the lead architect for the Windows operating system. When Jeffrey left the PowerShell team and became the lead architect for the Windows operating system, I went, what do you think the future of PowerShell is in Windows? Right? And if you notice that Windows Server 2012 had 2,300 new commandlets. PowerShell 3 was released simultaneously last year with Windows Server 2012. 2,300 new commandlets. Essentially, the same thing is happening with Windows that happened with Exchange back in 2007. The interfaces are almost entirely available via PowerShell. Jeffrey said last year at the MVP Summit, at the keynote to the MVP Summit, the PowerShell is a core IT skill. Learn it or be left behind. So I thank you all for being here. I think it's a wonderful tool. I have been using it since 2006. I love using it because I can do things once, save what I've just done as a script, and do it as many times as I want to. Right? So it's a repeatable process, and that's what's most important. Having been, and you saw on my About Me slide, I've been a lot of disciplines. I've been a Unix system administrator. I got used to working with the Unix shell, both Corn Shell and Born Shell, I worked a lot with, and I got used to shell scripting, and I was so thrilled when PowerShell came out because it gives me that same power, that same ability to get a lot of things done quickly. All right. So you'll notice through most of my demos that I spend a lot of time at the command line, all right, because Okay, I'm old. I've been in IT since 1974. We didn't have a GUI back then, right? So I'm not uncomfortable with the command line. The nice thing about PowerShell, even the command line, is there's this tab completion feature where you start to type a command or type a file name or something, you hit tab and it automatically fills it out for you. And if it's the wrong thing, hit tab again, it'll pick the next candidate that matches what you've already typed. So it helps you along as you're going. I mentioned that I start working and then I save what I've already done and that becomes my script. That happens through the get history commandlet. I can redirect get history to a text file and that becomes the foundation for my script, and that's how a lot of the work that I do gets done. All right? I can use the up and down arrows to scroll through the commands I've already done to do things repeatedly without retyping the command each time. Try that with the mouse and clicking on things. It's not very repeatable. In fact, if you're getting old like me and the hand kind of jiggles a little bit as you're working the mouse across, you a lot of times miss that little checkbox. Doggone it. I hate getting old. Anyways, so PowerShell 2.0, PowerShell 1.0 came with only a command line interface. PowerShell 2.0 introduced the integrated scripting environment, which allows you, you know, it's like working in Management Studio to a certain manner. You can type in commands and say, okay, highlight this line and execute it. You can do that. There are a lot of features to it. I didn't personally care for the 2.0 integrated scripting environment. It was too choppy for me. I want lots of space in my command line. Integrated scripting environment 3.0 fixed that. It allows me to fill the whole space with the command line area, and it gives me a lot of neat features that go along with it. I'll show that to you in a minute. One of the important things about PowerShell is by default, you cannot run scripts. So when you first start up your machine with PowerShell on it, try to run a script, it will not allow you to do so. It comes by default with an execution policy called restricted. PowerShell MVPs consider best practice for you to go into administrator mode in PowerShell and use the set execution policy commandlet and change your execution policy to remote signed. Remote signed allows you to, any script you create on your local machine, it'll just run. Any script that you copy to your machine and unblock, you can just run. Otherwise, the script must be digitally signed. All right? But also, you have to fully specify the path of the commandlet or the script before you can run it. So you can't just say, put this script in my command directory, and it'll just find it using the environment path variable. Because that became a problem with cmd.exe. I could create a script called dir.bat and put that in a folder that was ahead of the Windows command folder in my environment path variable, and I would type dir and it would run my script, not the Windows directory command. That's called hijacking. And by forcing you to specify the exact location of your script, PowerShell prevents that kind of hijacking. It's a security feature, right? Now, if you're running SQL Server 2008 or SQL Server 2008 R2, those products install on your system an executable called sqlps.exe. That executable is PowerShell 1.0 with the SQL Server snap-ins that give you the SQL Server environment, some of which I'll show you a little bit later. SQLPS.exe, the execution policy for that is remote signed. The reason for that is that SQL Agent for SQL 2008 and 2008 R2 calls SQLPS.exe to run the scripts that you've put in SQL Server Agent if you select the PowerShell task type. The reason I'm specific about SQL 2008 and 2008 R2 is the rules changed with SQL 2012. SQL 2012 requires that you have PowerShell 2.0 already existing on your server, PowerShell 2.0 or greater. And it uses a module called SQL PS. And you import the module, and then you have all the SQL Server features for SQL 2012, but it uses native PowerShell the way that the PowerShell team wants you to do it now. The SQL PS.exe was the way the PowerShell team wanted it done back then. All right? That was 5 years ago. Times change. All right, so that's your environment. PowerShell, and I take a little bit of exception with what Jeffrey Snover said in his session this morning. He said it's object-oriented. It's not object-oriented. It's an object-based language. Object-oriented has inheritance and all this good stuff that programmers really like. We're not programmers. We're administrators. We don't like that stuff. Okay? But it does use objects, and it uses them very well. Objects are simply variables that have methods and properties already defined for you, so that it allows you to work with those objects easily. So the things that I used to have to do in Born Shell and Corn Shell, there's lots of seats up here, folks. Things I used to have to do in Born Shell and Corn Shell using the pipeline that exists in PowerShell and exists in those shells, you know, you take the output of one command and you pipe it to the next command, and it just operates on that. Well, in Unix, you have to use these text editors and manipulators like sed and grep and awk and those kinds of things to manipulate that text data so that it was in a format that the next command could use. You don't have to worry about that in PowerShell because everything's objects in PowerShell, and all of the commandlets understand object structure, so you just send it on down the pipeline. You don't have to do all that special manipulation. All right. So commandlets are the basic functionality in PowerShell. They're what allows you to get work done. They're easy to figure out because they use a verb-noun naming convention. So if I want to know all the processes running on my system, I type in get-process, and boom, there they are. Right? If I want to stop a service, my other example up here, type in stop-service, give it the service name, and it's down. It's done. One of my favorite, when I'm working in my VMs, stop-computer. Shuts it down now, right? No messing around with waiting 60 seconds or any of that business. It just shuts it down. Or if I'm in the middle of installing stuff, I say restart computer, and it does a reboot. Boom, done. It's very simple, very straightforward. Now, there are three commandlets, and they're on the screen for you. There are three commandlets that I find extremely helpful in doing anything I do, and I use all of them all of the time. The first, of course, is get help. Get help allows you to learn about whatever commandlet you're working on. Now, PowerShell 3.0 introduced a new requirement for you to use help. You have to use the update help commandlet and go out and update your help from Microsoft because it doesn't ship with the full help that you would expect. But the reason they did that was because they had to include in the original help files all of the different languages all over the world that people were using PowerShell in, and they thought, well, that's kind of silly. Why should we load that on all of your machines? Why would you need Lithuanian on your machine if you're not speaking or working in Lithuanian language, right? So that's one reason. The other reason is that it's much easier to get you updated help if they have a facility to do that. So the update help allows you to regularly go out and get changes and fixes because they're people just like we are, and they make mistakes, and they put things in the documentation that aren't necessarily exactly correct, and the PowerShell MVPs go and say, hey, this help function, you know, this help document is incorrect. It really works this way. And so they go and fix it, and then it's available to you via update help. By the way, you can post connect items on those help items as well. If there's something you find that isn't quite right or it doesn't work the way you think it should, go to connect, post an item on it, they'll get back to you and let you know if they can do it and when they do it. So Get Help is a wonderful way to know how to work with PowerShell. PowerShell does use aliases, so for those of you who don't want to type in Get Help, you can just type in the word help. Or if you're a Unix person like me, you can type in the word man. The Unix help is man pages, so manual pages, so man works as well. The second one that is extremely beneficial is called Get Command. Get Command brings back the list of commandlets that are available to you. And you can use arguments to limit whether you want just the nouns or just the verbs or whatever. You can use wildcards to discover what the commands are. All right. So that'll let you understand what commands are available to you. And the third one is Get Member. Get Member tells you the structure of the object you're working with. So you have data stored in a variable, you pipe that variable to get member, and it'll tell you all the properties and methods available for that object. That's your discoverability. That tells you how you can work with PowerShell and with that object. Don't do what I've done and use the equal sign as a comparison operator. It's never, ever a comparison operator. It's always an assignment operator. And I've had scripts go horribly wrong because I've forgotten it, and I regularly forget it because I'm just so used to using it as a comparison thing. That's what we've been taught through math through our entire lives. But in PowerShell, it's always an assignment operator, as is the plus equal, the minus equal. I think slash and star work for division and multiplication as well. I don't play with those very often. I do use those three fairly frequently to assign values. Comparison operators, dash equal, dash EQ for equal. Not equal, less than or equal to, greater than equal to, etc. Those are your comparison operators. Variables, you have to have variables in any language so you can temporarily store values. They begin with a dollar sign character. They are the .NET objects. Again, use Get Member for your discoverability. Let's take a look. So I'm now in the PowerShell ISE. You notice what it's doing for me? You guys can read this all, correct? So it's suggesting commands. I didn't want get command, I want get process. And I type in get process, and there are all the processes running on my system. Real easy. I can type in get process and suggest a name. And so I get a limited set of processes, so I can use wildcards. I can do something really fun. Pipe the output of get process. Let's scroll this up a little bit so you can see. Pipe the output of get process to the where object. It's the where object commandlet. It aliases to where. And I want to What was I thinking now? There it is. So there are the processes that are running on my server where the handles are greater than or equal to 1,000. I could say get process, pipe that to sort, and sort on the working set, descending. Pipe that to select object and select the first 10. I now have the 10 most memory-consuming processes on my server. Real quick status of what's going on my server. Now, as I get more into using PowerShell, I want to do some iterative things. I can do an interesting thing. I can say $i equals 1.10. And that loads an integer variable with the values of 1 through 10. Right? I can take I and pipe that to get member. And there are all the methods I have to use with an object of type system.int32, which is what an integer is in the .NET world. I can set a value string equal to yes, I am from Cleveland, and it does rock. I really do love living in Cleveland. I always say Cleveland's a great place to live, but I wouldn't want to visit there. But they keep changing that. They keep doing things like adding the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Could make it an interesting place to visit, too. All right, so get member. You can see I have a property called length. So I can look at the length of that string and determine whether or not I have a value there or how long it is, what I need to do with it, that kind of thing. These are the kinds of things that I can do to work with PowerShell. All right, I'm going to end this introduction because we've got so much more to cover. But if you have questions, I'm going to be down in the database platform booth later on this afternoon, and feel free to come on up to me. We can go into all kinds of details on the on basic PowerShell itself. But for now, I want to get back into why we're really here. We want to gather data about our servers, right? We want to know what's going on our servers. We want to know what our environment looks like. So the first thing we do is we capture a server inventory. And I see you taking a picture, sir. These slides are going to be available to you. You'll be able to download the slides, so you don't have to take pictures of the slides. That's easy. And in fact, I think they're recording all these sessions, so you'll be able to go back and watch the whole thing. And pause it when I stutter. So, but you want to have an overview of what your domain looks like. You want to know what servers you're managing. You might have servers that you don't even care about, right? So you want to put together some kind of an inventory to know what's going on. It allows you, again, the outliers, it allows you to see things that might be a problem. I went into a client site one time and they were having a problem with this particular application and they wanted me to figure things, you know, see what might be the problem. And the first thing I always do is do a server inventory of all of the servers. And I gathered the data, I looked at all the configuration parameters, and I found that the server that they're having the problem with, they had set max server memory to 512K. Yeah, exactly. I went, hello. But it's real easy to overlook that if you're managing one server at a time. If you have an inventory, you can see those outliers fairly easily, fairly quickly. Okay, you can look at the resource usage. How much are you using? What's going on right now? What is it going to look like going into the future? You want to regularly gather how much disk space you're using, how big your databases are, those kinds of things over time, and you can graph those. I'm going to show you that in just a second. You can create reports that will allow you to see the progress, because I'll guarantee you, if you go to the boss and say, we're going to run out of disk space today, you're not going to look very good. Boss, we're going to run out of disk space in 6 months. Can we put together a PO and get some extra disk? You're going to look a lot better in that scenario, right? And having these reports will help you anticipate that. So what do we collect? We collect the computer name, the model, the make, the operating system, version level, the patch level, how much memory each one has, how much local disk each you have, you know, what are your disk allocations, how much free space is on each of those disk drives. You also want to gather information from SQL Server, the version, the edition, the service pack level, where your default data log and backup paths exist, right? All of your configuration options. That's where I found that max server memory issue was in the configuration parameter. You want to look at the database files and their sizes and how much free space they have. You want to look at the logins, the users, and look at the permissions that those logins and users have to make sure they don't have permissions they shouldn't have, right? One of the ways we do this is through Windows Management Instrumentation. It's a nice feature that Microsoft built into the operating system, and we can query WMI and get just about anything related to the Windows operating system, right? So it gives us access. It has a set of classes that we can query with a very T-SQL-like language, okay, to the point where I just do select asterisk from Win32 computer system, and then I select out the properties that I want out of that. So I use computer system to get the physical information about the computer, operating system for the OS stuff, physical memory, again, and if you're on a physical machine, each individual memory card will have a different row coming back in the Win32 physical memory namespace. Logical disk will give you back your disk space information. If you specify with Win logical disk where drive type equals 3, that's all of your local disk. So not your mapped network drives, but local disk, and SAN storage is considered local disk. So you'll get back all of that information. In PowerShell version 1 and version 2, the commandlet you use is getWMIObject. They discovered that that's a little bit heavy-handed, though, and with PowerShell 3.0, they introduced the commandlet called getCIMInstance, which is a lighter weight, and they've deprecated getWMIObject. That doesn't mean it doesn't work. That means they've deprecated it. So. But the getCIMInstance uses the WinRM interface, which is a much lighter weight HTTP-based protocol for getting information from WMI. Another thing that is really cool with WinRM, it's outside of the scope of this presentation, is PowerShell remoting. All right, if you get a chance, go down and find some PowerShell guys down in the exhibit hall area and ask them to show you remoting. I've got another session, but it's not completely on that. I'm going to actually be doing that. SWUG, the SQL Server Worldwide User Group, has got a summer camp coming up in July, and I'm doing a presentation on using PowerShell remoting to manage SQL Server in that summer camp. So anyways, CIMInstance uses that lighter weight WinRM interface to do its work. So let's go into demo mode. I'm now in a virtual machine that's running Windows Server 2008 R2 and SQL Server 2008 R2, which is probably similar to the environment that a lot of you guys are running at this point. I know they tend to like to use all the latest and greatest at these conferences, and that can be a little frustrating sometimes. So, now get WMI object. I can say select asterisk from Win32. This is why I need help sheets. And I have it right there. One thing I forgot to mention is for strings. This was for the intro section. For strings, there's two ways of delineating strings, double quotes and single quotes. Double quotes will allow for variable substitution. So if you're passing a variable into a string and you want that expanded out, like you would do in a script, if you were passing in a database name, for example, and you wanted to query from that database, you'd pass in the variable with the name of the database. Double quotes allow for variable substitution. Single quotes do not substitute variables. So if you have embedded dollar signs in a string and you want it to leave it that way, then the single quotes would be the way you'd go. So here's the basic information from WMI. I'm running, my system directory is system 32, build numbers here, registered user. Not really great information, but if I type in OS equal that, here are all the properties that I have available to me from the Win32 operating system. So I can query any of these properties. So I can get the build number, build type, the country code, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Same thing with let's look at logical disk. If you type a bunch of stuff or you inadvertently paste into, and I'm pasting by right-clicking in the window. If I paste and it's like it's not what I wanted, hit the escape and it just clears that line for me so I don't have to backspace through the whole thing. So type in LD here, and I can see I've got three drives, the C drive, the E drive, and the F drive. They're all type 3 because I specified that. And they're all 40 gig in size. And here's my free space. I've got 19 gig available still on my C drive and 40 and 42, respectively, on my E and F drives. So it's a nice way for you to be able, you can take that data and you can use it from PowerShell, call a SQL Server stored procedure, and insert it into a database table, and along with the date, and do that on a regular basis, either daily or weekly, and then you can graph that over time, right? Somebody had a question over here? Okay. Well, yeah, you have to store it. You'd have to store it. You can't look at the WMI is not going to give you anything but what's going on right now. All right? So now one of the things that I need to do in a SQL 2008 world is I need to load in the SQL snap-ins. And I'll post a blog post. I'm at sqlblog.com. I'll post a blog post for you on this with the scripts and demos and such. So there's this script that Michiel Waris wrote back in 2008 called Initialize SQL PS Environment that loads the SQL... Oh, I'm in the wrong place. Oh, that's why I'm in the wrong machine here. Here we go. Michiel Waris wrote this script. He blogged it in 2008, and it loads the 2008 SQL snap-ins. It essentially turns the whatever power, version of PowerShell you have on your server, on your system, into SQLPS.exe. But you still get all the benefits of the newer version and its features. All right. When I'm running, I'm sorry? There is a 2012 equivalent, and I don't have a 2012 instance fired up right now. The 2012 equivalent is import module, SQLPS, and then you use a parameter called disable name checking. It will work if you don't include that parameter, but the PowerShell team, starting with PowerShell 2.0, came up with a list of what they consider approved verbs because they didn't want people, one person choosing stop, another person choosing kill, and a third person choosing terminate to mean the same thing, right? So they said, here's our list of approved verbs. What they didn't include in that list of approved verbs were backup and restore. We're SQL people. This is what we use, right? So we have to specify disable name checking so it doesn't flag backup and restore as invalid commandlet names. All right, so but import module is usable with SQL 2012. Prior to SQL 2012, use this script to initialize your SQL environment, and it gives you the SQL world available to you. All right, so I want to actually close this so I don't get confused. But once I've done that, I can then go into SQL Server and instantiate a server. Instantiate a server-based object. So I'm using the PowerShell new object commandlet, instantiating an object of type Microsoft.SQLServer.Management.SMO.Server. Yes, we're going to go into SMO just a little bit, just so you can see this. But once I've done this, I can look at S information, and here's my server name, my version, my edition, my master database log path, and master database path, all of the basic information about SQL Server there. There's also a collection under there called settings, which contains my backup directory and my default data and log paths. Michael?
Can you iterate those properties and throw them into an XML or something like that?
Can you iterate those properties and throw them into an XML? Yes, you can. You can. I haven't needed to do that. But these are the kinds of things that you can gather, and this is how you can gather them. What I do want to do, though, is I want to show you that, yes, we're getting this data through SMO. All right, the server management objects was introduced in SQL Server 2005 and continues to be used through SQL 2012. Haven't played with 2014 yet. They haven't made the bits available to us. All right, as soon as they do, I'll start playing with that. But the nice thing about SMO is it supports all the way back to SQL 2000. So you can gather data through SMO about all the way back to SQL 2000. All right. You have to load these assemblies. That's what that initialized SQL PS environment did for me. Then we connect to the server using the new object instantiation and connect to either the server object or connect to the managed computer object. The managed computer object is actually corresponds to the configuration manager. You've used configuration manager to work with SQL Server. So essentially the objects you see in the managed computer object correspond to that. So just a real quick diagram, and then we're going to move on. Here are these are the objects under the SMO server object: configuration options, settings, information. I just showed you settings and information. I can drill through my backup devices, my endpoints, logins, databases, and the job server is the start of SQL Server agent, right? So all of your agent objects are under job server. If you're looking for database file information, You want to go into each database object, go into the file groups collection, and drill down, and you can get down to each individual data file and find out the name of the file, the file name is the property there, is the physical name. The name property is the logical name, right? And it also gives you the growth and max size and gives you file size information. Log files don't fall under a file group, so you don't have that file group's collection above it, but essentially it's the same thing. And here is the diagram for the managed computer object that allows you to go through, and you can actually go in and you can set you can set the service account or change the password. And this is one of the demos I do in my remoting session, where I can go out to all my servers all at the same time and change the password of my service account. Kind of cool, right? Because that's a complicated thing and tedious to do if you're doing it through the GUI. All right, let's get back into the demo mode because I wanted to show you this. The other way you can get to this is you can change to the provider. And I wanted you to see the SMO objects. Because by using initialized SQL PS environment for SQL 2008 and R2, or importing the module for SQL 2012, you are given the provider, the SQL Server provider, that allows you to navigate SQL Server as though it were a file system. So here, I'm now in the SQL Server PS drive, the PowerShell drive, and CD to SQL, and CD to SQL TBWS, which is the name of my server, and then I can CD to INST01, which is my instance that I mostly play with. I can change directory then to the databases collection. And there's the list of my databases. I've just done a directory. I do LS, by the way. LS is an alias for get child item. DIR in PowerShell is an alias for get child item. Right? So you can type DIR. I like LS. It's my Unix basis, and it's one finger from each hand. I'm lazy. Right? So here are my user databases. My user databases. Well, what if I want to look at my system databases? Dash force will bring back the system databases as well when I'm in the provider. I can change directory to AdventureWorks. And there are the collections that are available in my database object. I can also say $DB equals get item dot, meaning my current item, wherever I am. Dot means where I am right now. Let me scroll this up so you can see it better. db.name AdventureWorks. So I now have in the $DB variable the SMO database object, and I got there by doing a get item inside the provider. I hope you're understanding why I walked you through those SMO objects, because you don't need to code the new object method that I did when I showed you the server object earlier. You can just walk through the provider and grab items and start working with them. It becomes a very powerful way for you to keep that server inventory information available to you. Ultimately, what you want to do is something like this. Here are the services, the SQL Server services that are running at a client site. And I need to zoom it. Sorry, I should have. This was one thing I forgot to do before when I rebuilt this system. I rebuilt my deck yesterday. not the deck, the virtual machine, because there was an error and I wanted to clear it for you guys. But if I go in here and I paste in the home directory, I can paste it here. So what I've got here is a list of all of the services that are SQL-based services. This is from the managed computer object. Server overview, these are the three servers, product name, product edition, level, et cetera. Configuration options. I know this is small, but I want to run through this real quick because you will be able to do this same thing. And it's not magic, it's already built for you. I actually downloaded a CodePlex project yesterday and executed it, and this is where this data came from my server, but the CodePlex project. Here's a case, here are all the permissions for the logins. This is all done through PowerShell. Okay, logins, server logins, server roles, credentials, audits, server objects. Again, this is at the server level. If I keep scrolling, I've got also information on, this is database mail. Here are all the databases. And there, here my recovery model. My recovery model for each of my databases. You see, I'm a little inconsistent there. I might want to take a look at that. My data file count, log file count, my sizes, my configuration information for databases, files, file groups. As a consultant, I walk into a client site and the first thing I do is run this script, gather this information. I can then walk through. There's this spreadsheet. There's also this spreadsheet here, which is this one's an analysis spreadsheet that also comes with, and this is also in the CodePlex project. Kendall Van Dyke wrote this project, and you can download it today. I downloaded it yesterday. And what it does is it looks at various properties, and it shows, boom, I've got auto shrink enabled for this database. So might want to take a look at that. In fact, the database name is AutoShrink. That's deliberate on my part. All right. But it looks at all of the various properties, much like Bren Ozar's SP Blitz. This thing evaluates your servers for known potential issues. That doesn't mean it's something you need to correct, but it's something you might want to look at. Okay. There are reliability options. My last good DBCC check DB was over 2 weeks ago. I might want to take care of that. It's just like a hit list of what I want to do on my servers to manage my environment properly. All right? So those are available to you. And at the end of the deck, I've got a reference to the CodePlex project. But when you download the CodePlex project, you create, under your documents directory, create a Windows PowerShell directory, and then paste the contents that you download into this one Windows PowerShell directory, and you run the get SQL Server inventory to CLI XML script. And then the second thing you do is you convert the CLI XML to Excel, and then you have the spreadsheet that I was just showing you. Okay? Powerful piece of code, and Kendall did a marvelous job with that. So, I'm in Excel. All right. So that's the server inventory part of the world. The other thing you want to do, how much time do we have? Half an hour? Wow, cool. All right. So the other thing you want to do is you want to capture performance data because you want to know on a regular basis how your servers are performing. Without a baseline, you don't know what things look like normally, right? If you don't know what things look like normally, you don't know where to go when something starts not behaving normally. It's those deviations from the norm that help you identify what the problem really is. But if you don't have the baseline, then you don't know what that is. So you want to start capturing this stuff. Frequency is important. If you capture data once a day, you're going to miss a lot. If you capture data once every 10 minutes, you're probably still going to miss a lot. As a rule, I start off with once a minute. It gives me 1,440 data points per day. And generally speaking, that's enough. It's not too much data to store in my database, because if you do it like once a second, okay, multiply that by 60. That starts to become a lot over time. I don't necessarily want to do that over time. All right. But I find that once a minute works pretty well. If you do it too seldom, you're going to miss things. So the thing you need to know is, which counters do you want to capture? Counters are important. You want to know what counters to look at. Again, there's no right answer. There are a lot of people around that know SQL Server really well, and each one of them has a favorite set of counters, and these are mine. First is percent processor time. I want to know how busy my processor is. If it's over 80%, I'm going to want to take a look at what's going on. And even though the accountants like it when my servers are running at 80% capacity, my users don't, right? Because they're not getting the performance they want out of their applications, all right? Memory is important. If I'm only running SQL Server, one instance of SQL Server on a server, and I'm not running anything else, I really don't need to look at memory. But if I add integration services, if I add reporting services, if I add another instance, or heaven forbid somebody puts something like Excel on that server, I want to keep track of memory, because those things will start chewing up memory and not me leaving it available for SQL Server. So I track memory just to know that I do have enough memory, that if it starts to get low, I'm going to start paging, which goes down to the next counter, the paging file percent usage. If I start using the paging file, I'm taking system memory and I'm swapping it out to disk. That means I'm slowing down. I don't want that to happen. So I want to keep track of that information. I also want to look at physical disk, average disk seconds per read and average disk seconds per write. Regardless of what my IO subsystem is, these counters will give me latency values that are consistent and they're useful. All right? If I'm waiting more than 100 milliseconds for the IO subsystem, I probably have a problem and I need to go talk to my SAN administrator. Right? If I'm under 20 milliseconds, I'm golden. It's good. Right? So you want to take a look at your latency to make sure that your IO subsystem is keeping up with the demands given it to it by SQL Server. And I also want to look at my system processor queue length, because if I don't have enough processors, then I end up in a thread starvation scenario and everything starts to slow down. So if I don't, and I've actually had clients in this situation and have said, can you double the processors, go from 4 to 8 processors, and all of a sudden a 3-hour end of month processing process went down to 45 minutes just by adding additional processors because they were in a thread starvation situation. SQL Server counters, I check out forwarded records per second and page splits per second from the access methods. The forwarded records per second gives me an idea of how fragmented my heaps are. Now, hopefully I don't have any heaps, but if I do, and they start to get fragmented, I might want to address that if they get really fragmented. Page splits per second just gives me an idea of how much work the IO subsystem within SQL Server is having to move things around. And if that gets out of hand, I want to get in and do some index reorganization and minimize that fragmentation that way. Buffer cache hit ratio is not as useful as it used to be back in the old days, when we were on 32-bit hardware with 20-megabyte hard disks and things like that. You remember those? Yeah, I actually have a 10-megabyte hard drive in my old Amiga 2000. Anyway, So the buffer cache hit ratio is still useful. It lets you know that you're still hitting most of your data requests out of your buffer cache. Page life expectancy is an interesting counter because the target has traditionally been 300. That's what was in Books in Line for a long time. Well, 300 is like the buffer lasts in memory for like 5 minutes, and that number was appropriate for 32-bit servers with a maximum of like 4 gig memory. We're not in that world anymore. Jonathan Kahias of SQL Skills did a blog post last year or the year before on this, and he determined that the target number that you should be looking for now is something like data cache size in gigabytes divided by 4, and then take that number times 300, and that should be your general target. That said, there are things like DBCC CheckDB that take your PLE and take it right to the basement. Those are known activities. As long as you know that's going on, then when you see it in your data analysis of your performance counters, then you go, oh, okay, that's when we ran DBCC CheckDB. What I use this for generally is for trends. I look for when that number drops and look at what might be happening when that thing drops and to see what applications are running to see if maybe there's some performance tuning I can do on that application. All right? Yes, sir. The data cache size? Well, what I'm going to ask you to do, the question is why data cache size and why divided by 4? I'm going to ask you to go to Jonathan's blog. Just look up page life expectancy at sqlskills.com, and you'll see Jonathan's blog, and he goes into a very detailed explanation of that. All right? But it's the amount of space that you've set aside for your data cache, or that you've that SQL Server will allocate based on your max server memory. That's a nutshell. I'll let Jonathan go into the gritty details for you. All right. Again, he explains that well in his blog post. All right. Processes blocked. You're always going to have blocked processes, but you want to keep an eye on it, because if it starts to go up, that means people are having to wait to get their database requests done. And there might be something like somebody in marketing ran the report that they're not supposed to run during the day. And by seeing that counter, you can see that that's happening, and maybe you can intervene in a timely manner rather than having everybody scream at you. All right, batch requests per second just gives you a rough idea of how busy your system is. And it's just a general counter to let you know what's going on, how much activity is actually going on. The last two, SQL compilations per second and recompilations per second, really give you an idea of how up-to-date your statistics are with respect to how the data is actually laid out on your server. And if these numbers start going up, you might have a situation where you need to start manually updating statistics so the query processor can make better decisions on creating execution plans. So I keep an eye on these just to see that they're not starting to climb up, that I might be in one of those situations where the auto-update statistics percentage doesn't quite work in my favor. There's actually a trace flag now that it uses a better calculation, but I don't remember what the trace flag is off the top of my head. It was just something recently published. So how do I gather the performance data? I've written a script, and I'll include it in the download for you, called getPerf, where I use this method. I instantiate a new object of type system.diagnostics.performanceCounter. I then give it the category name, the counter name, and the instance name. Those specify the specific counter that I'm looking for. And then I use the next value method for that performance counter object, and it returns the same number that I would see in perfmon. I can use that number then and insert that in my database in my SQL Server database and store that once a minute. And I wait that defined interval, that 1 minute, and I go and do it again. I set up that for each of the counters, and I've got scripts at client sites running this and storing this data once a minute, 24/7. Another way that I've done is I haven't been able to implement yet another non-Microsoft solution. So I can use Perfmon, and I can create a custom counter log. And I store that in a binary log file. How many of you guys have worked with Perfmon binary log files? Right, a lot of us. And there are a lot of tools out there. But what I found in PowerShell, I can use this import counter commandlet came into play in PowerShell 2.0. So if you're using 1.0, it's not available to you. But 2.0 or 3.0 and greater, import counter is available to you, and you can iterate through that counters, extract the ones that are meaningful to you, use the cooked value property, and store those in the database. The important thing is get the data, get the performance counter data, consistently into a database table. And when you've done that, I've written this report. So this is one server called CLE-SQL 01. 6/4/2013 is today. These are my percent processor used, my batch requests per second, my buffer cache hit ratio, and my PLE up through 5 a.m. If I were running getperf and loading it directly into the database every minute, it would be up to the minute. Okay? But these are 24-hour periods, 6/3. Here's, again, percent processor use, batch requests per second. Here's the normal graph. This is the normal PLE pattern for a business day at this particular site. This spot right here is where they did DBCC check DB. This spot right here is in the middle of the day. So something they're doing in the middle of the day, doing some processing, is bleeding down the PLE, and then over the course of the rest of the day, it grows back up again. This is a weekend. Can you tell? But by using this report, I'm able to see the pattern over day after day after day. If I want to look at the detail, I click on the date, and it goes in and runs another report that's specific for that day. These graphs on the comparative analysis report are called sparkline graphs. And SQL 2008 R2 reporting services started to support sparkline graphs. It's a nice, quick way of getting quick information. Here's the detail graphs. So I can see my performance, my processor percentage here. And here's my buffer cache hit ratio in this top line. Here's my PLE. And now I've got the actual numbers to work with. So I can see what those numbers look like. Okay, so this number in the middle of the day, it's low, but it's not so low that it's really hurting me a lot. So I don't really have to worry about that. Here's my batch requests per second. Tells me how busy my system is. My disk latency, you can see in the wee hours of the morning, I've got some latency issues. Why? Because every system under the sun is doing its backups and it's nighttime processing then, so I'm doing a lot of heavy I/O then. I would expect a higher level of latency than I would want during the business day. And lastly, I've got a graph on block processes and the processor queue length. I don't have, maybe right here there's a blocked process. Here I've got the processor queue goes way up for a brief moment, but overall it's not anything I really need to worry about. Below that, I've got the detailed data so that I can look at actual numbers besides the graphs. But the graphs give me a pretty decent picture, and I've just gathered this from my baseline data. It's just taking that baseline data and putting in a graph. Another thing that I do is disk usage analysis. So I've got a graph for each drive on this particular system. So my C drive stays pretty consistent. My H drive, you can see my size is up here at 350 gig, and this line shows some variation, but it's not approaching that top line. So I know that I'm not running out of disk space. And that's the whole purpose of having this graph, to keep an eye on how close I am to running out of disk space, because that's the last thing I want to do. This is actual live system data from one of my client sites. And it's actually from about a year and a half ago. I just keep updating the dates so that it comes up. In these reports, I've said, give me data for the last 35 days. Right? So I just update the data in the reports. And another report that I've created here is the database space analysis. So I can look by database. You can see I've got a growth point here. Let me go into... You can see I've got a growth point here, and I've got another growth point here. Now, auto growth is a nice feature to rely on should something go wrong, but how many of you want it to go on in the middle of the business day? Right? I don't. Auto growth all of a sudden stops any activity going on in that database. And everybody has to wait until the auto growth amount is satisfied and the database is the new size. So I want to take care of that myself manually. Here's another database. Each database, I get to look at the growth. This last one, this MRI table backup, you can see a progression of growth over time. So that's something I want to start taking a look at and finding a regular way of manually growing it, like on the weekend or something, when I don't necessarily want to interfere with client activity. So that is essentially what I do with PowerShell to gather that server and performance data, store it in a database, create reports, and start looking at it and managing my server on a regular basis. Where can you learn more about this? GetHelp is a great resource. Update it regularly. If you're on PowerShell 3.0, use the update help commandlet, and like once a month, update your help so you have the latest and greatest. But that's the way you can discover almost everything you need to know about PowerShell. If you want to just learn it, Learn PowerShell 3.3 in a Month of Lunches by Don Jones and Jeffrey Hicks. Wonderful, wonderful book to get you up to speed in PowerShell. I wrote a white paper about 5 years ago on understanding and using PowerShell support in SQL 2008. So that's available to you now on the MSDN site. I also wrote an article called Let PowerShell Do an Inventory of Your Servers. I did not show you that script here, but it's an article I wrote back in February of 2009 where I used WMI and SMO to gather information about my servers. It stores that the script that's available you can download from that site, and it's also in the downloads I'll put on my blog post later this week. That script stores all of the data in CSV files, which you can then use and import those into SQL Server so you can gather your data that way. I wrote this years ago. Kendall recently created that SQL PowerDoc project, which is the last bullet point up here. It's called SQL PowerDoc. It's at codeplex.com, and it is a wonderful tool because it just throws everything in Excel, and I can sit down with a client and, because I'm a consultant again, and I can walk through and see where my problems are. I have actually sat down and said, look, here are all the people that have SA privileges on your server. Do you really want all of these people to be SA and be able to delete everything that's there? Really? So those are the kinds of things we can do with the tools that we have available to us now. And PowerShell is just the tool that we use to get to that. So that is the content. There are some additional sessions coming up. I didn't put any sessions that have already passed by. But Don Jones and Jeffrey Snover are doing a session at 1:30 called Advanced Automation Using Windows PowerShell. They have a really great session. They have a lot of fun doing their session. You'll learn a lot of really great things there. Also, SQL Server Management Basics for Non-DBAs is a good session. Denny Cherry is a SQL Server MVP. He's a SQL Server MCM, Certified Master. He's also a VMware master, whatever their category is for that. So Denny's got a session at 5 o'clock today, and Sean Kearney is doing an integration with System Center and Windows PowerShell as well. All good sessions for later on in this event. So please, please, please fill out an evaluation. You'll have the potential of winning something, and I get to know if I've met your needs, and I hope I have. Thank you. Thank you so much.